Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined in the sweltering heat. I saw someone in the comments reminding me yesterday that today was going to be even hotter than yesterday, and indeed, it has come to pass. Joining us today is Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm generally fine. I think habitually I always say I'm doing very well, but in fact today it's slightly less so. I was really flattered, Nicholas, before the show that you commended me for having washed my hair in a saucer full of water, which was all the water that was to be had when I needed to wash my hair for the show. I haven't shaved, unfortunately, so listeners and viewers, please, forgive that, and glad listeners will be spared. But aside from that, and the fact that the electricity is off, no water, no electricity, but in good company, so I'm well in
indeed,
that sense.
Indeed. I apologize, and please let me know, gentlemen, if you can hear my little desk fan here, but I have that on because I'm sweating myself into oblivion. And joining us with no electricity and no internet, using his cell phone, is Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I very much to my detriment, I don't have a fan.
No.
My mother might
indeed.
But that's about the closest to my home.
I mean, I think it says a lot for the IRR that we managed to look how cheerful we all look, and we're all present and correct and willing to share our thoughts on all sorts of interesting things.
Yeah, we've got nothing to offer you but, you know, banter, soil, sweat, and tears, or what?
Well, someone has to do it, so I suppose it might as well be us.
Indeed.
Let's talk about our first one here. And this is the city of Tshwane. Or the municipality of Tshwane, which, according to some reporting that's been going around, is in a bit of financial trouble. According to some of these reports, which were put out there by the local government MEC in Gauteng, the municipality failed to settle debt to Eskom of 1.6 billion rand, paying only 492 million of its electricity bill in September. And as a result, Maile, MEC for local government, said as a result of facing the possibility of disconnection of electricity services, and it's had its fleet parked due to the unavailability of diesel, as the municipality allegedly had no money to pay service providers for the supply of diesel. These reports suggest the city is experiencing serious financial problems. The mayor of Tshwane, who is of course a coalition mayor, responded that the MEC's decision comments were very unwelcome. Because, according to Williams, quote, it would be appropriate to remind the MEC that many of the issues faced by the city of Tshwane today are a direct result of the 4 billion rand deficit incurred when he unlawfully placed the city under administration in 2020. They took surpluses from the years before and wrecked them. We have systemically been working to turn around the finances ever since. This information and further details will be communicated to him in my formal response. It's also worth noting that there is some evidence that they have been taking some of these financial problems seriously, because there have been a lot of very aggressive disconnections of services for non-payment in Tshwane, even in some cases overzealous, as one of our colleagues was telling us the other day. But that's neither here nor there, I think, for the moment. Herman, what do you make of all this? Who is to blame here? This is obviously not a great look for the coalition government if it's struggling to pay bills, but do they have a point to blame the MEC and the province for the financial situation that the city of Tshwane is in?
Well, it certainly seems like there's at least some prima facie case that the government of Tshwane can make. If you look at the annual report of 2018, looking back on the 2017-2018 annual report of the city of Tshwane in terms of, you know, the municipal management questions. In the financial overview section, it's 2019 report, but it is about the financial years preceding 2017 and 2018, therefore. One sees a few positive movements in those years: an improved credit rating by Moody's, an increase in the city's total assets by 5%, an increase in total income by 5%, an increase in total expenditure by 3%, and the generation of a surplus of an adjusted 2.4 billion rand compared to 2.5 billion rand in 2017. So the positive cash balance was very much a thing before 2019, or at least at the time of 2019 of this review. And then we look at the placing the city under administration by the provincial government. And then you actually do see the incursion of debt close to, I'm not exactly sure if the figure of 4 billion is perhaps rounded up or rounded down, but it certainly seems to be close to that number, where suddenly in 2020, the city's financial state becomes very quickly much worse, going from budget surplus in the previous 2 years, and in the previous years also seeing its credit rating improve. It then in 2020, spectacularly, the debt situation for the city changes. Now, I haven't looked yet deep enough to see whether that was the spending by the municipal government itself or whether it was, like Randall Williams says, a result of the provincial government, which we should remember is an ANC government, placing the city of Tshwane under administration. But so far, the facts do certainly seem to line up in favor of Williams a bit more than Maile. And it is perhaps worth pointing out that earlier, well, not earlier this month, but in the middle of September, you know, second week of September, Tshwane and Eskom agreed to a payment plan where they would pay incremental sums over a period of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 dates. And that total sum that they would pay during those 5 dates would amount to 620 million rand. They've, if I look at the figures, they seem to have gone beyond that. They've seemed to pay to have paid more than they what they had originally agreed with Eskom to pay. They haven't settled the entire 1.6 billion bill. And the worry I had was that there seems, earlier I remembered this idea that it looked like Williams had said, Mike, the debt with Eskom has now been settled. But what I'm looking back now, actually said was that a plan for settling the debt has been agreed with Eskom. So it, I haven't looked deep enough to come to a perfect conclusion, but the facts and the figures and the publicly available finance measurements, deals, reports certainly do seem to support Williams's claim that the city's budget problem stems from a period in 2020 that coincides with the period of provincial administration, and also that so far they have done, it seems, relatively okay in honoring their debt payment agreement with Eskom. So to me, it does smack of politics. And Nick, as you pointed out, having the DA-led government having lost power in Johannesburg, they are, the councillors are now facing problems from basic facility providers like water and power, where these municipal support structures, not under political control, no longer cooperate constructively. So I must say, the facts do seem to indicate that something untoward is happening, and it is not, it's not smelling like it's the fault of the local government here.
So, Michael, it really seems as though every single inch of territory and power is going to be fought over as the ANC kind of sort of dwindles and seems to lose power. I mean, that some of the polling we've seen from Gauteng in particular suggests that they're going to be in big trouble in the province. But I wonder then whether suddenly, if the ANC is still in national government in 2024, it will decide that, you know, Gauteng's really not that well run and it should probably be placed under administration. firstly, what do you make of all these? We might only get to it later in the show. I don't know if we'll be able to cover it today. The city of Joburg's ejection of the mayor of the coalition mayor, the DA mayor, Paul Palatse, is being taken to court. The city of Tshwane's placement under administration was also taken to court. What do you make of all of this fighting? And lastly, on a sort of related question, you know, what is the importance of Tshwane to the politics of 2024? Our colleague Gabriel has suggested that the road to 2024 lies through successfully running Tuane. Do you think that that's a possibility?
That's an interesting point. I mean, I living down in Cape Town, we tend to be a bit distant from things on the ground up country. But I just happened to hear a conversation earlier this week from somebody who was, I would say, probably more hospitable to the DA than perhaps to most other parties. And he was saying, you know, Tuane is really the big test. The things haven't really gone very well for the DA. And this is going to be, you know, a key factor in how the party is either able to just sell their proposition or how opposition parties are going to be able to point to Tuane and say, well, you know, look at this example, forget about Cape Town, let's look at Tuane. And I don't really know the facts, but I was quite struck by that in fact Tuane might indeed be a telling instance. I certainly agree with Herman. I think there's the kind of level of politicking here seems pretty blatant. Once again, one has a sense of the kind of desperation of the ruling party. It's quite staggering to think that it's actually been in power for longer than Nelson Mandela was in prison for. That's an awfully long time, and I think it's beginning to dawn on the country that it's going to take a long time. It's going to be a long, hard slog to recover from this long and error laden period.
Something that I just want to add to what Michael has been saying to that is we're looking at the results of CADA deployment. For so long, CADA deployment and opposition to it has been sort of a niche issue, a victimless crime. And whether this was envisioned by the ANC,
perceived as a victimless crime.
Yes, perceived as a victimless crime. Whether this was the long-term plan of the ANC to effectively capture statal institutions so that it doesn't matter who wins elections, whether that was the intention or not, the reality is that CADA deployment and opposition to CADA deployment has been of niche interest. And when citizens, one tries to thread the needle on criticizing citizens and criticizing politics, because there's a lot of blame to shift around. But there is an extent to which political parties have failed to make CADA deployment the sufficient, casus belli it should have been. But there's also a failure from the electorate to engage with that issue and to fundamentally understand that CADA deployment is not just a scheme to make crony is rich. It is that, of course, but it is also a way to capture institutions quite blatantly. And we're seeing it now in Johannesburg, we're seeing it in Tuane, and from what I hear, I have only had anecdotal reference to what's happening in Ekurhuleni, there's a similar situation where the civil service is the opposition to the incumbent government. So whenever someone complains about the state of coalition governance here, they should remember that CADA deployment is a massive part of what is now leading to the troubles these municipalities face.
Now, I remember being told some interesting stories by City Power technicians back in sort of 2016, 2017, talking about how apparently, the level of political interference in the administration was extraordinary through the sort of use of deployed cadres, and they would receive such instructions as places where I think some of Zuma's kids lived, as well as the suburb where one of the speakers lived. I'm not quite sure about that though. These technicians would apparently be told, according to them, to prioritize these places if there was a power outage. Yeah. Because otherwise they might face some kind of disciplinary action. One of the technicians told me that anyone who spoke out about misuse of contractors or anything that sort of seemed like wasteful expenditure would be fired almost immediately. So never mind just the sort of straight up CADA deployment stuff and the political intimidation that goes on of supposedly neutral civil servants. There's also just a shocking culture of kind of fear and arse covering and just hiding from any kind of responsibility, I think, in the civil service. And that's going to take a very long time to wash away. Now, Michael, do you have any final thoughts before we move on?
Mm. I mean, that's really the thing that worries me, is that, you know, we're clinging to the hope that, you know, a change in the political arrangement of forces is going to signal a new departure for the country. But I fear it'll take much more than that. It's a question of dealing with all those embedded figures in institutions, people who are, you know, committed to one or another ideological line or political party. And it's going to be a question of dealing with what's been put in place over 28 years. It's going to require, you know, nerves of steel, political wisdom, patience, and determination to push through. I think it's going to be quite a job, but that's the job we will have to confront if we're going to turn the country around, I think.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, so let's move on to our next topic. This one, I think, is not so important as to the great political future of the country, but it's the kind of thing that really annoys me, I guess, because when it comes to sort of control of people's personal lives, I in particular turn from being a sort of kind of conservatively liberal type person to being an out-and-out radical libertarian in this case. There is coming through cabinet, it was drawn up in 2018, although it seems to only be passing through cabinet now, is South Africa's new tobacco control bill, which aims to firstly include e-cigarettes, or vapes, as they're often called in the sort of regulations around smoking, as well as further tighten restrictions on where smokers can smoke. One of the proponents, who is from the National Council Against Smoking, said this bill is a strong, updated piece of legislation that closes loopholes and addresses aspects not covered by current legislation, such as the proper regulation of novel products, including e-cigarettes or vapes. Proposals in the bill, in particular, 100% smoke-free public places, health warnings, and a complete ban on all marketing and advertising come at low or no cost to the state. They go on to claim that this support to have 100% smoke-free public places has wide support amongst the population. They also go on to say that e-cigarettes have been marketing recklessly and have not been able and have not complied with the other smoking legislation because of loopholes, and now that will be brought to an end. So e-cigarettes will not really be able to be marketed in the way that they are now. Even cigarettes will have even fewer opportunities to market themselves. Apparently, you're not going to be able to even see the box. You're just going to see a price list. And vending machines are going to be removed for cigarettes, so that in the hopes that underage smoking will be cut down on. One of the most controversial things is the incredible tightening of where you can smoke. One of these being that apparently you're not going to be, according to the media reporting, and I haven't been through the legislation with a fine enough tooth comb to say for sure, that you will not be able to smoke in any indoor space if there is a non-smoker in the same space. So in other words, you can't smoke in your car if there's someone who's a non-smoker in the car, and that kind of thing. It will be an offense to do so. And this is, of course, not the first time we've seen the government being very tough on smoking. Of course, during lockdown, Dlamini Zuma, for reasons completely unrelated to coronavirus, although they were done under that banner, smoking was banned in the country for several months. Michael, what do you make of this issue? I mean, you know, we can attack this from the specifics of this law, the principle involved. I don't know. What do you want to go from here? Obviously, smoking is bad for you, but, you know, the question is whether the state should be stepping in to control it. What do you make of
it? It's quite a difficult one in a way. I mean, I sort of grew up with, you know, a world of smoking, and became a smoker myself. I smoked for 45 years until December last year. You know, I was quite a committed smoker. I love smoking. I can watch people even now having a puff and think, you know, oh, I know just how nice that is. And of course, it's maybe one out of every 80 cigarettes that is actually enjoyable. It's a bit like having, you know, a coffee 24 hours a day or anything else, taking any other substance into your body. It becomes a habit. And I remember, you know, the great joy in the old days, and I'm talking about the 80s, say, of getting into an aeroplane and being really, really impatient and irritated that you have to wait for the little nose-making light to go off, which is, you know, perhaps 5 minutes into the flight. And then you could light up. And on, you know, international flights, you go through a pack of cigarettes. And you imagine all the lighters and the matches and the, you know, in that highly sort of inflammable environment. I've been, over my lifetime, I've been very conscious of the steady shift towards, yeah, what truly is wisdom and good sense and you know, a better way of living, which is, you know, less pollution of the air that people who don't smoke want to breathe, and so on. My family are very relieved that I've stopped. So there, I can see all that, and I think it's a movement which is not going to stop. Smoking is really one of those odd things. I think it's quite an old-fashioned, peculiar sort of pastime that's maybe a bit anachronistic. You know, puffing on leaves and it's a bit smelly, it's messy. And I think it's, you know, it's bound to go. Maybe more interesting maybe would be to look at liquor. You know, is liquor going the same way? People, it's also this potentially dangerous thing. Maybe it's not quite the same. But then I also share your anxiety about the intrusion on personal choice. On the Daily Friend, we've published a lot of really convincing argument from Ivo Fechter, among others, that vapes are in fact a key element of recovering from or getting off smoking. You ditch smoking and you manage to clear yourself of the habit by going through vapes. I can't vouch for that. I had to stop, and I did stop. And I did toy with the idea of vaping, and then I thought perhaps the risk would be that I'd drift back to smoking proper cigarettes as soon as I felt a bit better. It's a complicated, I think it's quite a complicated thing. I think it's one of those historical movements it's going to run its course. I think fewer and fewer people are going to be smoking. In my lifetime, I remember going to dinner parties and at the dinner table, you'd turn to the hostess or the host and said, could I have an ashtray, please? And you just, by then you were already lighting your cigarette. You know, it wasn't as if you had to ask permission, or it was just, you know, where is the convenience I need at this point to put my ash? Right. And you're sitting right next to perhaps somebody who detests smoking, never smoked in their lives. And it was just, you just took it for granted. So that, I mean, the shift in the past 30 years has been enormous. And I think that's
For me, there's two sort of clear lines here. There's the cultural movement against smoking, which, while I'm not entirely on board with it, I'm not really a smoker. I smoke sometimes, but, you know, I think it goes too far, but I don't think there's really anything fundamentally wrong with the cultural movement against it. And as you say, I think, you know, people, the smoking culture has become a lot more respectful of other people over the decades. As you say, that, you know, just lighting up and puffing away and your host's nice carpets is no longer a thing that happens without permission.
No.
And yet there's something to me that just that rankles me in an incredible way here. This seems like an incredible intrusion. I mean, one of the things that the bill here bans, for example, is you can't smoke in a place that may be used for domestic work. So in other words, if someone ever is paid to come clean your house, maybe it's even only once a week or something, you can't smoke in your own house, which seems completely crazy to me. Herman, what do you make of all this? You're famously a president in chief of the I Hate Vapes and I Love Cigarettes Club. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, famously. No, I don't smoke. There was a while where when I sort of had a pipe where I puffed, but then I realized, you know, if you're going to self caricature, you have to budget for it. But part of the so I'm not massively on smoking. I'm not terribly against smoking. I don't particularly enjoy being around smokers, but I when they smoke, but I certainly like smokers. Someone like Michael is a very good example. So in a sense, what bothers me about this is I have a lot of sympathy for the arguments against smoking, but at no point do I think there's any mandate for the state to get awfully involved in this. My relationship with Michael and my decision to spend time with him or not is an economic decision. I sort of have this question of, is my desire for the company of Michael outweighing my desire to be in an environment where I can't smoke? Is there a possible, you know, opportunity cost for me asking him and to not smoke while I'm in his company? Would that offend him? And you know, people make these decisions every single day of their lives. So if the law here was in terms of what's it, Pirates of the Caribbean, if it was more of a set of guidelines than law, I'd be sort of fine with that, because I do think smoking isn't healthy. I think vape is even worse. I think it is a cheap way for big tobacco to sell addictive things to kids. But the
I'm in the shelf of vape camp here, so I disagree with you on that final point.
That's fine. But what we do agree is the fact that why can't people make this decision for themselves? I think you can you pick a point of departure, and then you sort of see where it leads. Banning smoking on airplanes, I think that makes some sense. You can't open a window. Mitt Romney found out during his campaigning. But if I am a restaurant owner and I want to cater to smokers, who the hell is the government to tell me I can't? If people don't want to come to my restaurant because they don't like smoking, I have to budget for that loss of patronage. I have to take that into account. And I need to sort of make that call on a level that affects the bottom line of the value-add service I'm trying to render. The idea that my clients or I can't decide for ourselves what is a comfortable proximity to tobacco usage for ourselves is, I think, absurd. And the game is given away in the title of the law, tobacco control. If any legislation that you find that comes down to control, it really gives a bit of the game away. If it was the tobacco regulations thing, perhaps they would have been a bit more smart about it. I don't think smoking is particularly good, but I think it people, I mean, if smoking allows Michael to be Michael, who the bloody hell is the government to say that he can't do that? And wondrously, Michael came to the conclusion that he shouldn't smoke without getting a call from Parliament or any recommendation from the Speaker, as far as I know. I mean, it would be spectacular for a parliamentary intervention to be staged for Michael, and he's such a national treasure, he might deserve it. But the infantilization of people not to make their own decisions is, I think, embarrassing. In a time when we really have bigger fish to fry, to focus on this is, I think, naive. Of course, there is some leeway here between the libertarian idea and the control idea, and that is to make for some insurance that tobacco companies need to have, you know, treatment policies or something. A part of their tax is ring-fenced or whatever for the treatment by the state of people they sell their things to. Because the moment you have state health service, then prevention becomes the business of the state to a very large extent.
Now, right, I don't that's the more complicated issue here, I suppose.
Yes. Mm. So, and that's a fair issue to discuss. But I do think that this particular law goes too far. It doesn't address the point, and it infantilizes people like our government has sort of gotten into the comfortable habit of doing. And ironically, as Nkosi Zanalamini Zuma showed us with her perfect case study, it will likely have close to zero effect on actual tobacco usage.
So very briefly, we've gone a bit long here, but I just want to cover one last story. And this is the surprisingly defeated tone that ANC President Cyril Ramaphosa gave in comments recently. So he went to accept his nomination in Soweto from the particular ANC branch he belongs to for leadership of the ANC. And in the sort of acceptance, he said this: "No other leader has faced the challenges I've had to deal with. As our people were dying, as unemployment was rising, the economy was going down, the unrest that had an impact on our economy. That has been my lot as president. But I have given it my best shot." Seems a bit grim. Herman, any thoughts, very briefly?
Well, that doesn't sound like someone with too much gas left in the tank. He might be in a dark place. He might have an off day. We do have those. But I must say that the spinelessness and the lack of fight explains a lot of the political mistakes that that Ramaphosa has been making. He doesn't sound like someone with much fire left that can ignite again. But yeah, I must say that's in very interesting mood music for a president to play, is to describe his presidency sort of in the near recent history.
Michael?
Very telling, I think. And you know, one half gets a sense also that neither he nor the party he leads actually knows what to do. It has any sort of clues to, you know, how comes home early from being abroad to deal with the electricity crisis, but what was there for the ANC to do within its parameters, within its imaginary space? Nothing is the answer, other than what it has been doing all along, which has been causing the crisis.
So, my favorite part to get about Ramaphosa hasting back to South Africa to intervene in the crisis is he then, if I understand correctly, hosted online meetings, which he could have done the Lincoln bedroom in America.
Yeah.
Oh, what fun. All right. That's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with the Daily Print Show. Cheers, everyone.